Sorry, that was kind of loud. I'm not used to the big gong. It does have such a rich, deep sound, though, doesn't it? It's really beautiful. So, good evening. I'm Brigitte. Gil wasn't able to be here tonight, so I am sitting in for him. And he told me that last week he talked about desire. So I thought I would follow up this week with aversion. So I know some of you longtime practitioners have probably heard many, many talks on aversion. So I apologize to you and suggest you just do whatever you need to do. And for those of you that are newer to the practice, hopefully there'll be something of use, something of value for you. I'm a lot more familiar with aversion than desire. It's much more my topic. We all, you know, have certain leanings. In Buddhist typology, they're considered to be three different kinds of personalities. And it's not, it's just one way of looking at ourselves. It's just one way that we can see how we view the world. But basically they're greed, aversive, and deluded. And most of us fall into the greedy or deluded, aversive types. And it just means that's the filter through which we see the world. So I tend to fall in the aversive type, which means that I tend to view things from a perspective of what's not right, or what's not there, or how things should be different, or how that's, you know, that's just not exactly the right way, or it should be just a little more this way. Whereas a greed type would be more wanting everything, wanting to take it in. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, I want that. So you can just sort of think about it for yourself and see if it's obvious which category you fall into. Without judgment, you know, realizing that we're all one or the other. So there are pitfalls and there are advantages to each. So not to judge it, but it can be very useful to know that that's the lens through which you see the world. I have a friend who came to me one time with a project that she was going to do, and she, you know, was just putting it out, wanted to know what I had to think about it or say about it. So I started saying, of course, some concerns I had. And then I laughed and said, you know, you didn't really want to come to me, did you? And she said, oh, yes, I did. I knew you would do that, but I wanted that. So us aversive types can be useful for some things. We can be a pain in the butt, too, but... aversion is really the flip side of greed or desire. They're not so very different when it comes right down to it. Or we could say that aversion is really a type of desire, because it's a desire to have things different. It's a desire to have things a certain way, not the way they are. It's also a turning away. It's a turning away from things. It can be a closing of the heart. As I say, not wanting things to be the way they are. And there's an assumption in that, of course, that I know how things should be. I know the way things ought to be. And if they're not, then, you know, I push it away or I turn away. I don't accept it. And there can be much suffering in that, much, much suffering. It can also be a useful way to discern, to discriminate, to see things clearly. Sometimes being able to see what's not there, what isn't right, what could be different is very, very useful. If we can come from a non-reactive place, if we could come from a more objective or discerning place, But when it comes out of just that reaction, no, I don't want it, that's not right, that's not good, it can be very, very painful to us, and it can be very painful to the other person. Sometimes it's very useful to know that about another person also. I'm thinking of, as a child, that learning that my mother's first reaction was always no. So you'd ask her something and you could just count on it would be no. Well, once I got to know that, then I could just sort of, okay, wait a few minutes and then go back with it. And invariably she would change her mind or something would be different. But that first reaction was no. No, you can't do that, or no, that won't work, or no, that isn't right, or whatever. As I say, as a child, then when I learned that, I didn't have to be so reactive to it or have to be so upset by it. I just knew, okay. And then go back and repeat or wait a little bit and try again. With aversion, there is judging. I used the word, I think, discerning or discriminating a minute ago. That can be very, very useful to be able to see clearly, to be able to parse out what is useful and what is not. That can be discriminating or discerning wisdom. With aversion, there's a judgment. The words I've been using, it's not okay, it's not right, it's not good enough, it shouldn't be that way. And that's the aversive part. That's the part we want to see clearly because that has the reactivity. Judging, as we all know, can be very, very painful also. Painful to ourselves, maybe most painful to ourselves, but also painful to the people that we're judging. So aversion is also one of the five hindrances. There are five hindrances that we talk about in Buddhist practice. They arise both on the cushion and in our daily lives. And they are called hindrances because they're just that. They can get in the way. They can get in the way of our clear seeing. They can cause much chaos and, again, much suffering. So the first one is greed. The second one is aversion. And that's important to know and important to see as it arises for us because that creates the turning away. The other hindrances, if you aren't aware, are sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. And doubt is sometimes considered part of aversion. In Buddhist practice, unfortunately, I think, a lot of states are lumped under the term aversive or aversion. And I think it can be very, very useful for us to see each one clearly and to not just name everything aversion. Sometimes some of the states that are listed, I don't necessarily agree, are aversive, but that's the way it's put in Buddhist typology. A feeling level is talked about in Buddhist practice. And that feeling level is the idea that things are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Most times, not neutral, but either pleasant or unpleasant. The unpleasant is the aversive part. And what we find is most times we're wanting to latch on or pull to us the pleasant, push away, turn away from, have nothing to do with the aversive or the unpleasant. So that, again, can be very, very useful to see. So how do we deal with these? Well, let me just say first, there are aversive states, and I'll list and talk about several of them. Then there is also just plain aversion to those states. And that's kind of like the suffering that we add on to the pain which is inevitable. So an aversive state, say anger or fear or doubt, arises. And then instead of just accepting, acknowledging and accepting that's what's there, we don't want to feel it. It might be very strong, it might be very painful, it might be very uncomfortable, and we don't want to feel it. So then we turn away from what is actually happening. There's aversion to what we are actually experiencing. And I think the most painful, the most harmful, is turning away from our own experience. And I say that out of my own experience. I am seeing more and more clearly how I have turned away from my own experience, denied my own experience, had an idea of how things should be, and then tried to fit myself into that. And oftentimes, it wasn't at all what was true for me. So in some ways, sometimes I feel like a babe, you know, just coming back to what is my actual experience and embracing that rather than denying it, pushing it away, turning away from it, not allowing it fully in. It can also be quite painful, actually, because usually we have turned away or denied our experience because it was painful. It was very, very uncomfortable, and so we may have learned at an early age not to let that in, not to acknowledge that. Mindfulness, as always, is our biggest tool, our greatest tool for dealing with any states. However, it's also true that sometimes we're not able to be mindful. It is possible that some aversive states can be so strong that we can't be with them. We just can't. And so that's important to recognize too, accept and allow. If we can't, we can't. Then the tendency is to dissociate in some way or, you know, get lost in thinking, get lost in something else, and not be present, not be mindful. I remember early on in my practice, I was having a lot of pain in my leg. I think it was on retreat, and I remember saying to Gil something like, "Why should I be present? All I have to do is think, and then I don't feel the pain." And he said to me, "I'd rather you moved. I'd rather you move that leg than get lost in thinking." I was wanting to do it right, you know, and stay still and not move and try to stay with it. But it became so unbearable at times. And I noticed, you know, the mind would just go to thinking. That was much easier. It was very hard to keep it right on the pain. But, you know, those words stayed with me. Don't get lost in thinking. Don't dissociate or don't do anything else. If you have to move, move, but stay present. You know, stay present for the moving rather than getting lost. So probably the strongest aversive state that we experience and the one that's talked about the most, perhaps, is the state of anger. And I think back in June or the last time I was here, on a Thursday night, I talked about anger. I think anger is very, very misunderstood, has gotten a very, very bad rap in Buddhist practice, and mostly I think it's very misunderstood. So I don't want to confuse anybody. I don't want anybody to think that I think that anger is wonderful and we should cultivate anger. That's not it at all. But I do think that anger is a human emotion, that it pops up a lot, probably for most of us, and it is a force to be reckoned with. It is something to be acknowledged and to be dealt with and not to be turned away from, not to be thought of as terrible or dangerous or whatever, and then denied or pushed away. Anger can be very, very useful. Anger can be a signal a red flag. Hey, there's something here. There's something that needs attention. There's something going on here. So again, staying present for the anger, being with it, and letting it show us what needs to be seen. As I said a few minutes ago, sometimes anger may be so strong that we can't be with it. And then in that case, it's important to acknowledge that. And if we're sitting, maybe get up, maybe do something else. If it's very, very strong, we might want to go for a walk. We might do some exercise. We might do something to use up the energy that's in that anger rather than acting it out. And then coming back to be willing to be present for it when that's possible. That's true, I think, of any of the states, that when a feeling is very, very strong, it's important to recognize that. If we can't be with it, acknowledge that and do what we need to do with the intent of coming back to it when we can. Another very strong aversive state is that of ill will. And often these two, anger and ill will, are equated. But they're actually, in my mind, very different. I can be angry and have no ill will. I don't wish harm on anybody. Ill will is the state of hatred or wishing harm. It's a very, very unpleasant state. Very, very painful. Filled with chaos and agitation and sometimes heat and burning. Very, very unpleasant. But also human, right? It probably comes up for all of us at one point or another. So acknowledging that, letting it be, but not acting on it, not being reactive, not feeling that we have to act on that strong feeling. There's a very, very well-known saying in Buddhist practice that hatred never dispels hate. This is from the teachings of the Buddha. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in love. In this world, hate never yet dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law. Ancient and inexhaustible, you too shall pass away. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? So I think that's an ideal. I think that's something for us to strive for. At the same time, recognizing that hatred does arise, ill will does arise, and acknowledging that without acting on it. We can see that in our society a lot, I think. What comes to mind is something like the death penalty, when some horrendous crime is committed and the victims or people identified with the victims may experience a lot of hate, a lot of ill will, and wishing the same pain, the same punishment on the perpetrator that may have happened to their loved one. But we see over and over how that doesn't work. Doesn't help anything, right? And occasionally somebody will realize that and say, wait a minute, you know, hating this person, wishing ill or wishing death on this person doesn't bring back my daughter, son, husband, friend, whomever. Hate never dispels hate. Love alone dispels hate. Another strong aversive state is hurt. Feeling wronged, perhaps. Feeling betrayed in some way. hurt can be very, very strong. And it's very easy to be reactive when we're feeling hurt. And in that, we may wish to hurt back. That's often the instinct to hurt back. I had an experience this morning of this, where in the scheme of things, a very, very small thing happened. But to me, it was very, very hurtful and touched a very, very deep wound. And whereas years ago, I would have reacted, and what I would have done was lash out, blame, and hurt back, probably. Because of this practice, and over the years, I was able to just be with it. I wanted to lash out, you know, my mind went to all the things I wanted to do, but I didn't do them. And I didn't even stay with that very long. I was able mostly to just stay with my pain. And it was very deep. It was very deep pain. It felt unbearable. And I recognized, you know, years and years of not wanting to feel that pain, of wanting to turn away, run as fast as I could. And I didn't. I stayed with it. There were many tears, very, very unpleasant, very uncomfortable. Uncomfortable is more accurate than unpleasant. You know, it's a little unpleasant, but actually, I have to say it wasn't all that unpleasant. It was uncomfortable. And the clarity that I was able to get by staying with it was very wonderful. I could see how what someone else had done was like, you know, they had just sort of flicked the button a little bit, and this button just went whoom. You know, it was so clear to me how that was old, deep pain. And just some little flick like that triggered it. Very, very useful to me to see that. That comes with many, many years of sitting on the cushion and learning to be with things, learning to tolerate, actually. Thinking I couldn't tolerate certain states and learning that I can. Very, very useful. Fear is another one. Sometimes I think it's not fair to make fear an aversive state. Fear, like the others, can be very useful. Fear also can be a warning, right? There's danger here. Be careful. But often we let ourselves run away with the fear. Our fantasies or our feelings or our reactivity just get caught up in the fear and we're gone. We're totally trapped in it. And then it's not useful. Then it's not very helpful. So again, being willing to see clearly, to see the fear, being willing to stay with it. Fear is another one that people often want to run from, want to turn from. I've had people say to me that they can't meditate because the fear comes up and it's too strong. They can't stand it and they don't want to deal with it. So they just don't. Sometimes it's important to get up and move or get away from it. But it is possible to learn to be with extreme fear, very, very strong sense of fear. Seeing where these feelings are experienced in our body. I mean really seen, not just, oh yeah, I know, I feel tingling or I feel it in my gut. Sometimes we answer so quickly, I know I have. This morning, really seeing in my body the tightness in my chest. My chest was just like this. It was so tight. I have felt that before, I've been aware of that before, but never quite so clearly, never quite so strongly. And letting that tightness show me what is underneath that. Show me what needs to be done. Also seeing how that tightness interferes with my breathing. You know, tightness in the chest can make breathing very difficult or very shallow or very painful. And being with it can allow it finally to relax and the breathing to go back to normal. So seeing where in our bodies we experience these strong states, and being with the bodily sensation, the body feeling, rather than the story. So easy to get lost in the story, right? But when we can just stay with the body sensation and not the story, then we're closer to home, we're closer to ourselves, we're closer to understanding and getting through whatever the strong state really is. Boredom, well, wait a sec, before I do that, let me read something from Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. This is a book by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. When a feeling arises, we don't accept it. We feel aversion. The unwillingness to be with and experience these feelings keeps us always reaching or grasping for something else. One of the most difficult emotional states we experience is the feeling of insecurity, of being vulnerable. What would it be like to be totally open? We think that if others saw us as we know ourselves to be, we wouldn't be loved or respected, that people would judge us harshly, that we'd lose all our friends. The fear of being vulnerable causes us to construct a self-image that we present to the world, one that we hope it will accept and love. We put that image out in front, while the dark, murky, unacceptable part of ourselves lurks behind. Does that sound familiar to anyone? It certainly does to me. And then, even if that image that we put out is accepted, we know it's not real. And so the acceptance isn't really very trustworthy or very complete, because we know we're being accepted for something that isn't really us. Boredom is considered an aversive state. I've heard it said that boredom is really anger. I don't know. I don't experience it that way, but maybe some people do. I think boredom can be not wanting to attend to what is going on, not wanting to do something that needs doing. It can be a subtle way of turning away. It can be a subtle way of turning off, you know, because boredom is usually kind of non-feeling. So it can be a way of turning off to what is actually going on, what we're actually feeling. There again, it might be a signal, a flag to look a little deeper. What is this boredom about? Generally, boredom, when we feel bored, we want to do something. We want to do something to get rid of that feeling. It's most uncomfortable. And often we react and get into a busyness or do something. It can be very useful to just stay with the boredom and see what's underneath. I don't get bored very often, but on the occasion that I do, I have learned, and I appreciate, going and sitting. And what I have found is, often it just passes. I don't know what it was, but it just passes. Or if there's something deeper, then the sitting allows that to arise, and the boredom dissipates. So you might try that. Sometimes boredom, I think, comes out of conflicting desires or conflicting aversions. We can't decide, perhaps. It's sort of a stalemate. It can be a stuck place. Judging. Judging can be a very strong aversive state. Criticizing, comparing, the Buddhist conceit, You know, in Buddhism, it's considered conceit to think you're either better or worse than or the same as, because it's all comparing. And comparing leads to pain, inevitably. Even if you think you're better than someone else, you have to keep proving that. You have to keep being better than somebody all the time, and that gets very painful. So either way, judging is very painful. It can be resistance. It can, with judging, there can be very strong attachment. Attachment to the way things should be, or attachment to I think I know how things should be. Attachment to an I, for sure. And again, continuing with what Joseph and Jack say, when we investigate the fear of being judged, of not being accepted, we see that it does not have to do primarily with other people. Instead, it has to do with our own unwillingness to experience certain of our feelings and emotions. It is we who are judging ourselves, not accepting ourselves, not loving ourselves. If we can allow ourselves to feel vulnerable and insecure when that is what is arising, if we can be totally ourselves without any pretense, we will find a greater inner strength. It is in just that moment when we acknowledge our shadow side, the side that we have kept hidden and under wraps, that our armor loosens. We begin to open the door of compassion for ourselves and for the human condition. Grief. Grief is considered an aversive state. It's important to make a distinction, though, because sadness, just pure sadness, is not an aversive state. In fact, actually, many, if not all of these states, when they're pure, are not necessarily aversive. They're just states. They're just what's happening. And unless, if we don't react aversively to them, they just arise and we're with them and they pass away. Sadness is a very human reaction. It's a very normal reaction. In fact, if we weren't sad at certain events, we'd probably be considered unfeeling, and it might be true. We might really be turned off. If a loved one dies, of course we're sad. When horrific things happen, of course we're sad. Sadness is just sadness. Recently, some of you may know, there was a very well-respected Zen teacher who died. And I know a couple of his longtime students. And they're very sad, deeply saddened. They've lost, you know, their teacher of 30 years. Very, very deeply sad. But there's no sense of it shouldn't have happened, or it's bad, or it's wrong, or what am I going to do? There's just sadness. Grief, when it's an aversive state, is holding on to that sadness. It's carrying it on. And there's no particular time limit, you know, that means it's gone too long. It can be whatever it is for certain people. But it's the holding, just like resentment with anger. Resentment, you know, is frozen anger or unacknowledged, undealt with anger. And it gets sort of solidified and it's really in there. Grief can be the same way. So we make that distinction between sadness, just pure sadness, and grief. If it's, you know, if grief is considered an aversive state. Despair. Despair is that sense of hopelessness or helplessness. Again, a turning away from a belief, a thinking that things can't change, or that this is terrible, this shouldn't be, this isn't the way things ought to be. really stuck or caught up in that sense is the state of despair. And ignorance is considered an aversive state. Ignorance is ignoring, is not being willing to see clearly, not being willing to be present for. It's not a not knowing, you know, it's an actual turning away from knowing or a refusal to know. That's the state of ignorance. Just sort of briefly, some of the characteristics of the aversive states. I've already listed some of them. There can be a sense of confusion, a sense of deludedness, a sense of stuckness, a sense of not knowing what to do, where to go, chaos. It can be a very agitated state. Any of these aversive states can be very, very agitating, very restless, very uncomfortable. There can be a lot of body heat that can be most uncomfortable. A lot of tingling or burning sensation. A lot of contracting in the heart, contracting in the throat, in the head. Various places in the body, that sense of contraction and tightening. Jack Kornfield says, "The unawakened mind tends to make war against the way things are." This is the aversive state, making war against the way things are. So I think I'd like to stop, and we have about 5 minutes for some comments. If anybody would like to make a comment, maybe something about aversion in your life or your experience, understanding of aversion.
It was fear that drew me to study the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, just my 18-year-old been sitting there and being terrified. I was very curious for it. I mean, I can understand if there was some catastrophe involved or something, then I could blame it on that terror. But just sit and be at peace and quiet, and to suddenly experience terror, it was so compelling. The curiosity that it generated, having to know, well, why? What am I afraid of? What is there to be afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the conclusion that eventually arose was that when one comes to a point where one may not exist in a sense of name, you know, kind of like I'm not really here. I'm kind of like a thought construction of myself. That I don't really have any sense of any real definition. I'm not my mind. I'm not my body. I'm not I'm not. And that in itself, the realization of that was, you know, well, no wonder I'm terrified. I mean, it's certainly you're terrified because I could imagine no greater threat. You know, I mean, when one dies or one's being murdered or something like that, that's one thing, but to dissipate oneself, to vanish completely, so completely, and there's not even bones left, you know. that's terrifying.
That's terror.
And,
yes.
And draws me, you know, every time I, you know, following the Dharma is very difficult for many people. And this person is one of them. whenever that comes to pass, whenever I kind of like would like to go, forget it, I'm going to be a scoundrel, it's
yes, the ego is very threatened by annihilation. Very, very threatened. And so it's the ego that throws up all that fear. The ego is the thought construct. Yeah. Fear, all of these states, I should have said at the very beginning, are common to humanity. We all experience them. They're all part of our lives. So there's not something wrong with us, or we're not deeply flawed, or we're not unique when we experience any of these states. They're part of being human. They're part of the human condition. And our job is to be mindful of them, to be as aware of them and with them as possible. And let them be our guide, really. Let them teach us what we need to learn. Let them show us where we need to go and what we need to learn.
In addition to your comments about feeling the embodiment of these emotions or these adversive states, a couple of comments on that. One is that I find by attuning yourself to how these things act in your body, sometimes states that are not fearful or not anger are really something else. That, for example, excitement has some of or anticipation has some of the beginning features of fear. So you can fool yourself, and if your fallback is always to think you're fearful of something, then you're just going to the wrong place all the time. So that's one thing.
Yes, very, very. Could you all hear him? Very valuable to recognize that, right?
The second thing is that I find that by this word compassion that you've used, by having compassion for that part of myself, that fearful part, or when difficult thoughts arise surrounding, and just to have that compassion or judgments of situations that I have that part inside of me, and that to be okay with it, just to be compassionate with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing I find that's very useful for me in adversity states is to do loving kindness for those.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yes.
I even have little mantras for myself on all these little guys.
Mantras of loving kindness.
Well, yeah. For example, like fear, I can say, "May my fear be happy. May my fear be filled with joy." And it's amazing the change that occurs inside at that moment that you can.
And I really like your point about, you know, some states can be mixed, or you can confuse them, like fear or an excitement.
Mm-hmm.
They're very closely. In fact, for me, often I find they arise simultaneously. You know, there can be fear, anticipation, but also excitement. And it's been very useful to see that. And then I just incline the mind towards the excitement.
Yeah.
I acknowledge there's fear, but incline myself towards the excitement. And the fear doesn't have such a strong hold. Yeah. Anything else anybody would like to share? Okay, we're right on schedule. Let's sit for the next 15 minutes. Thank you all, and have a safe drive home.